Tuss Talks, episode 25, the Halloween special. Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Test Talks. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com, and this is a podcast for anyone who wants to discover how to succeed with testing and automation, as well as what works for testing any software development project. And today, it's just you and me. And today, I'd like to go over the top six test automation anti-patterns that you should be scared of.
Number one, record and playback.
Record and playback. Now, this is an old-time anti-pattern, and I think it was more common back when more people used vendor-based tools. Back in the day, I started off in a tool called WinRunner. One of the features that was always talked about by the vendors was, oh, you just record your test script and you just play it back. It's that easy. And actually, very shortly after you have the tool in-house and you start recording, you realize that, yeah, record and playback really isn't going to work. It adds more maintenance than just straight out programming the test. Basically, this approach hard codes every single action and value that you enter into a script. And a lot of times when you're recording a test flow, different things come up that may not be handled in the original script, so you have to go and modify it. And so I've never had any good experience just recording and play and doing a playback of a script. There's always some sort of maintenance you need to do to it. They tend to be more unreliable over time. I can understand if someone wants to use a record and playback tool just to kind of learn an application and just see how the objects are identified. But after that, I really would recommend that people don't do a record and playback. You know, with Selenium, they have Selenium IDE. That can help you maybe identify some objects, and then you can export it to a scripting language like Java or C#, and then you can modify it. But you know, I found over time that it's a lot easier just to learn how to program the API directly and not have to even deal with the record and playback, because it adds too much overhead, and in the end, it adds more time than it actually saves you. And also, I think this causes another anti-pattern, which is people not treating test automation like any other development project. And so if you're just doing record and playback, it's almost like you're saying, hey, this is different than any other type of software development project. All I need to do is record and playback. You kind of minimize how much of an effort test automation really is. And because of this, managers get a false sense that test automation is easy, that it's not development, and it causes all kinds of other issues later on. That's the first anti-pattern you should be scared of. You should keep it in its grave. Don't go digging there. Leave it alone.
Number two, not planning your test framework.
So number two, not planning your test framework. So this may seem obvious, but sometimes when you're in the middle of a project and you have a deadline to meet, sometimes you just start and just getting things to work, no matter how bad it is or how hard it is to maintain, just to get something out the door. But you really would benefit from doing some high-level test planning before you do any type of automation. And in the long run, this will save you time overall anyway. So if you plan up front, later on, it'll pay you dividends later on down the road. And so what I mean by planning your framework is you should have a certain approach that all the different teams are aware of how you're going to be doing test automation. And it may be as simple as, how are you going to set up your project structure within your IDE? You know, where are you going to place your files? How are you going to break up your files? What your directory is going to look like? You know, what tools will you use for automation? For example, if your project tests both a web browser and also REST services, you know, what tool will you use for that? Most likely, Selenium for the browser base may be an option. And for REST testing, maybe you have an open source API like REST Assured that would help you do that testing. So it's really, really important that if you're working in a larger group with multiple Scrum teams and you're responsible for test automation, you really want to get this high-level vision in place first. So as you roll it out to the other teams, that everyone's on board and everyone's doing the same thing, this is going to save you a lot of time and headaches, because if people are unaware of what the vision is or what the standards are, they're going to start doing things however they want to do it. And then it's going to be hard to follow some of the tests that they write, because it's going to be so different from the other teams that may be writing automation. You want to have a standard so that when anyone looks at the test, that it's the same across no matter what you're testing and no matter what team is using the framework. So even things as small as naming conventions, say for your package name and your method names, you really want to get that standardized sooner rather than later. And if you're going to be doing something like continuous integration, you want to make sure that you run your standards by your CI team. For example, I started a project earlier this year, and I came up with some standards for naming packages and method names. However, maybe a month or two later, CI decided to have something called a check style in place, so that when someone checked in BDD code, it would check them for certain standards that it would flag and say, no, we can't build this because your code does not conform to these standards. But unknown to me, they decided on their own standards that were taken from the corporate level Java standards that I wasn't aware of. So of course, I had to go back and then change all our package names and method names to conform to this check style. If I didn't do that, we wouldn't be able to check in code to CI. So just make sure that your naming standards are in line with what other teams may be doing, and make sure you talk with other teams to make sure that your vision is also in line with what they foresee happening later on down the road, so it'll save you time in having to refactor. So I work for a large company, and in that large company, I was working on a project that had around 8 Scrum teams. So what I did is I put together, a PowerPoint presentation that went over exactly what the automation framework was going to look like, why I was designing it this way, what tools we were going to use, what problems does this framework resolve that we may have struggled with earlier on different projects, and what the overall philosophy was for how we were going to write our test and at what level. And this allowed me to get feedback from all these different developers and then take their feedback and maybe rework some things I didn't think of. And really, in the end, it's really a team effort where you're not only dictating, but you're also listening and taking that feedback and making it even better. So when you finally do roll out the final vision, that everyone is on board, everyone has heard it, and you should be good to go.
Number 3, not making your test framework maintainable.
Not making your test maintainable. So this really is a continuation of planning your test automation framework, but this takes a lot of effort. Long after you've planned the test automation framework, you have to really keep on top of this piece. So the best method I've found to keep the test maintainable is to use a layered approach. And what I mean by a layered approach is that you separate your test into main layers. So at the high level, you may have a high-level layer, which you're called your test. So if you're using Java, you would have a main test directory, and under that main test directory, that's where your tests would live. So in this first layer, you want to make sure that your tests are not code. For example, you should not be writing your test like you would normal Java code. It should be really at a high level where you've already created some high-level test methods that really abstracts the lower-level technical details out into another layer. So your first layer is more high-level what your tests are doing. And that, so when someone looks at this test, anyone could look at it and say, I totally understand what's going on, that they don't have to be a developer to know what's happening. So that's your very first layer. It's a layer that really makes it so your test will be more maintainable and less brittle later on down the road, because your test is separated out from the technical details that actually implements that information. So in this high-level layer, you may have something like, if you worked for an insurance company, an example might be user.ratePolicy, user.addCarToPolicy. So it's really at a high level. So you don't have technical information like if this, then that. You don't have switch statements. You don't have code in there. It's really high-level methods that you're using. And then in your next level, so this high level then calls a lower-level method, which is where more of your technical detail would be located. So if you had a high-level method like addHouseToPolicy, that would call a lower-level class that would be located under probably your main Java directory. And that's where the actual technical details, the actual Java code would live, where you would have your your methods and parameters defined. And then because we use Selenium, we have another layer, which is basically Selenium page objects. And basically a Selenium page object is a class that models a web page or a part of a web page. And that's where you actually have the low-level technical details of how to identify a field. So the great thing about creating your framework in layers is if you have a test called user.addCarToPolicy, and one of the fields change within your car screen, you don't have to touch any of your tests. All your tests would point to this one page object where you would go and make that change one time only. So that if you had 1,000 tests and you had to change a field name because the field name changed, you would just have to go to that one page object and make that change, and all your tests then would run and you wouldn't have to worry about going through every single test and making that change. So that's one huge benefit of creating your tests into layers. So another way you could think of layers is basically think of three main layers. At the top, you have basically your business rules. And then those business rules call a lower level layer, which is where would be your business flows. And then your business flows call page objects is where the real low level field information is located in your page object. So it's really more of your technical layer. So if you want to learn more about this approach, there's a really great course on Pluralsight by John Sanmez called Creating an Automated Testing Framework with Selenium. Now, even if you're not using Selenium, this approach would work for any type of automation tool. I've used something similar with QuickTest Professional. So I really highly recommend this course if you haven't seen it. And also check out episode 3 where we actually talk with John Sanmez. We go over some of these key approaches to help make your tests more maintainable, less brittle by using this layered approach. So I'll have a link to my review of John Sanmez's Creating an Automation Testing Framework with Selenium. And also I'll link to the Test Talks episode 3 podcast where we talk about the layered approach.
Number 4, over-automating.
Over-automating. An example of this is I've worked for a team before that had 2,000 automated tests. But the problem was none of them ran reliably. So they may have had just maybe 200 that ran reliably. So I came into the project and I said, hey, you know what we should do? We should stop automating and we should figure out why these tests are so unreliable. And I was told, well, no, we need to keep going. We have these offshore teams that are working in sprint and they're just pumping out these tests every time that their sprint is complete. But I told them, I said, what is the value of these tests? They don't run. So even if they complete a test at the end of their sprint, if we can't run them within our own CI environment and see that they pass, what value are they adding? Our goal is not to write automated tests. Our goal is to create a quality product. And one of the ways we create a quality product is maybe creating some automated tests that allows the manual testers then to go in and do more exploratory type testing. So if you can't even get a majority of your tests running, then why are you still creating automated tests? There must be something wrong with the process. Let's stop what we're doing and analyze what's happening. Because once again, our job is not to create automated tests. Our job is to test a product using multiple tools, automation being one of those tools we can use. So, you know, I'm all about test automation, but my main concern is that teams who are focusing all their efforts on automated testing, they're going to miss quality issues because they've been only focused on automation and that they're not focusing on issues that only a human tester could actually find using their eyeballs, right? We haven't solved this AI problem yet. So I don't know how managers think that we can create automated scripts that are omniscient almost and know exactly what they need to do. An automation script is only as good as you make it. So it can only look at things that you tell it to look at. It's not going to catch everything. So that's one of the biggest things that frightens me currently, especially when I hear managers say we want 100% test automation. It scares the heck out of me. And it is almost like perpetual Halloween at some companies that really try to force this nightmare onto their groups. I actually wrote a blog post called Can Automation Do Actual Testing? Based on a really excellent presentation from the friendly tester Richard Bradshaw. And basically in that presentation, Richard asked, "Can automation even really do testing?" So I'll also have a link to that great presentation within the show notes at testtalks.com/25.
Number five, not having a test data management plan.
So if you really want to avoid flaky test automation scripts, you really want to early on start focusing on test data management. Because if you start developing a lot of tests later on down the road, you're going to have issues where you may have tests that run that expect another test to run before it, and because it didn't, it fails, but it fails randomly because sometimes the test runs before and sometimes it doesn't. So you really need to plan this out ahead of time. And each test, so a good practice should be that each test should be able to run in isolation without any dependencies on any other test. And this is sometimes called an atomic test. So an atomic test doesn't care what order they run in. Basically, this approach will remove, you know, some of the biggest roadblocks seen when trying to keep track of some test data dependencies. You don't want to have a big spreadsheet where you say, okay, I need to run this test first and this test after that because my test won't run reliably because it relies on all this other test data being there before I run this particular test. You really want your test data to be independent. You want it to be isolated. So here's another example. I know of a team that has a suite of BDD tests that fail randomly. And because BDD was designed, and because some of these BDD tools like JBehave and SpecFlow were designed in such a way to incorporate some of these best practices like data isolation, they run randomly because they assume automatically that your scenarios are going to be independent. Well, this team's scenarios are not independent. Sometimes they go in and they expect a data to be in a certain state, but what happens is that another team had gone in and used that data and changed it so that when this other scenario runs, the state is no longer in what it expects. So the environment is not known, the data is not known, and that causes random failures. And this makes it really, really difficult to debug and analyze what's going on. So I've been reading this book, Continuous Delivery, that goes over a few methods on how to isolate your test data and make your test data more independent and more maintainable. And this other approach it talks about is functional partitioning approach. So this approach is if any test needs to modify a state of the system as an outcome, you want to make sure that the principal entities that you create in your test follow some test-specific naming convention so that each test will only look for and see data that was created specifically for it. So let's go back to our assurance example, and we have a test that adds a car policy to an existing policy. Maybe we have a unique name for that policy, like Joe's policy or add one car policy, and that no other test touches that policy, that we know just by the way we named it that that policy belongs to this test, so that when we run our test, no other team that runs a test would touch that policy, so that data would always be in a known state. Another approach that they recommend is maybe creating unique user IDs so that maybe you have user one, and that user one has data specifically tied to user one. So team one, sprint team one uses user one for all their tests. Sprint team two then uses user two for all their sprint team tests. So you still need to make each of your scenarios independent, but because each team then is using a unique username to log in, that you will avoid some of this collision going on because one team may not necessarily know what another team's test data is doing. So if you work in a larger group, it becomes a lot harder to really wrap your hands around this. And so one way to get around it may be to use this more functional partitioning approach that the book recommends. So it's a great book. I actually recommend it. And once again, it will be in the show notes.
And number six, treating automation as if it was just a checkbox.
So I think this might be one of the scariest anti-patterns that we go over here that I think everyone should be afraid of. And basically, it's a recap of pretty much all the other points we went over. And that is, you know, test automation should just not be a checkbox that you have on one of your definition of done. After you have a sprint, you just go, yep, test automation, done. You really want to be creating tests that add value to what you're doing. So if you have managers saying we want 100% automation, it's one of those weird metrics that people start gauging themselves against. So they'll start writing, they'll get 100%, they'll automate everything, but it'll be really bad, really, really unreliable test automation. And that's actually the opposite of what you want. You want to have test automation to cover as much as you can. However, You want it to be quality automation. If something cannot be reliably automated, then don't automate it. You know, if something doesn't make sense to automate, don't automate it. Don't just have it so that when you run your code coverage, it just helps you really pad your metrics. You really want to create automation that's going to help, and that it's actually going to help create a quality product, and that you don't have everything as an automated test just to say, look, all our tests are automated, we're covered, because that's going to give you a false sense of confidence in thinking that your application is a quality product. And most likely, if you have 100% automation, it's not going to be a quality product, because you're missing what the whole point of automation is. Automation should be ultimately just a tool within your quality toolbox that allows you to save time with some repetitive task that you can automate over and over again, and then frees you then to do more exploratory type testing where you can really use your business users to look at the application and really drill down to see, is this working as a user would expect it to behave? And that's really the only way you're going to be able to get that type of coverage. So automation is important. I 100% believe in test automation, but it should not be the only tool that you use to create a quality product. So if you're told otherwise, you should be afraid. So those are my top 6 test automation anti-patterns that you should be scared of. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you're scared of with test automation by leaving a comment in the show notes at www.testtalks.com/25. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.